One of the things that you can note about most people is that people rarely want their sins pointed out. And it should be understandable. We want to think well of ourselves. We want to have other people think well of us as well. And so it's difficult, it's awkward, it's not very comfortable to have your sins pointed out. In fact, the common response is for people to go back to the messenger and attack the messenger. They don't really want to hear the message, so the messenger must be wrong. In Proverbs chapter 15, Proverbs 15, and in verse 32, says, "He who neglects discipline despises himself, but he who listens to reproof acquires understanding." There are people who just won't listen to any type of correction, discipline, or reproof. They do so to their own harm. It is to our benefit to realize that we're not all perfect. We all make mistakes. We have flaws. We have things that need to be corrected. We have areas of which we need to learn. And so sometimes that means somebody's got to point out the fact that we're wrong. And it's an opportunity then to learn. What you'll often, though, often hear people do is quote verses like Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, which starts out, "Judge not that you be not judged." And usually that's about as far as they quote. But let's go over to Matthew chapter 7. Just for a moment, we will talk about the rest of the passage here in a little bit. But Matthew 7 verse 1, it says, "Judge not so that you will not be judged." And then the common application is, then you'd have no right to decide that I'm sinning. Well, the fact is, though, and this is the difficulty that a lot of people don't see, is that they are making a judgment themselves now. In applying that and saying you can't judge, they are judging. They're judging the fact that I'm wrong. Well, wait a minute, that's self-contradictory. Somebody must misunderstand something somewhere along the line because you're having something contradict itself. Or another passage is often used is in John chapter 8 and verse 7, which is going to form the basis of most of what we're going to talk about today. John chapter 8, verse 7, where Jesus tells the Pharisees and the scribes at this time, he says, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." It's oftentimes you'll hear it reduced down to, well, he without sin cast the first stone, or you shouldn't cast stones. The implication is that, well, we all sin, and therefore you can't condemn somebody who does sin. That's how this passage is being used. But what we're going to do tonight is take a look at John 8 in more detail, to understand it better exactly what is going on and why Jesus made this statement. Now, before we get into this particular passage, we've been studying on Wednesday nights about versions and translations and things like that, and this particular passage is an interesting one, so I decided to take a little sidetrack. Hope you'll bear with me. Because the passage from John 7, verse 53, down to 8, verse 11, is not in many of the early manuscripts. It's not in the Sinaiticus. It's not in the Alexandrius. It's not in the Vaticanus. It's not in the Ephraim manuscripts. And we've talked about all these major manuscripts on Wednesday night. They're all missing this section. But it isn't that passage is unknown in the early church. The Bizet manuscript, we talked about that one as well, does have it. Of course, that's not a great reference because we already know that the Bizet has all sorts of odd things in it and missing things. It's a very loose translation. It's not considered a reliable manuscript. And while the Vaticanus does not have it, there is a mark in the text that they use to say there's an alternative reading that exists. They just didn't think it was the proper one, so they left it out. So there is a mark saying they know at this point there is another passage in there, an alternative that they had not put in this particular place. Probably the biggest boost to this story is Papias. Papias, in about AD 125, mentions the story. He alludes to it. He talks about the adulterous woman. He doesn't give the whole story, but he obviously is clearly referring to this particular one. So all the way back to at least 125 AD, we know that it was around. Jerome mentions that it was in many manuscripts, both in Greek and in Latin, that he found it in many manuscripts. We don't have all the manuscripts Jerome had. At the time, we lost a lot of those. But Jerome mentions that this passage does exist. And so that leaves you scratching your head, okay, why does the ones that we have, major ones, is missing, but it seems to be floating around there and people do know about it. Well, one of the statements, quotes I found that I thought was very interesting, Augustine, I'm not a fan of Augustine, but he happens to make a mention of this. I think he gives a clue to the problem. He states that some skip this passage to avoid the idea that Christ sanctioned adultery. Some people read it and thought, well, Christ is sanctioning adultery. It can't be a legitimate passage, and they skipped it. And I've seen a lot of people try to explain away how this passage got accidentally dropped or moved. And I think probably the clearer one is that probably there was some early scribe or scribes who decided this wasn't the right one and dropped it out. And we just happened to have since it was done early on, it got replicated. Now, some also, by the way, speculate that it might have been a part of Matthew and got moved by accident over to John. Again, it's based on what Papias said. But I don't know if there's strong enough evidence for that. There are other evidence as well. There's nothing in this passage that contradicts the rest of the Bible. If you read through it, it is in consistency with the rest of the Bible. It contains all the traits of a genuine eyewitness account. It has details, but it doesn't go overboard with the details. Where the details are at, they're appropriate. They're what you expect from an eyewitness account. It doesn't read, if you read some of the false writings that are out there, they don't read the way the Bible reads. They're especially in the level of details and discussion of things, you can see that whoever's talking is really not an eyewitness. And this does not read that way. It is attributed as inspired by early Christian writers. They did know existed. I gave you one of the earliest ones. Its acceptance also is widespread. It's not complete. There were people who had doubts about it, but you find it throughout the early church, both on the western side and on the eastern side, it was heavily supported. It was accepted as genuine. And what I find interesting is while all the scholars like to debate about whether it's genuine or not, everyone, when you come down to it, says, yes, it's genuine. In one way or shape or form or another, they all say, yes, this is legitimate. While they like to debate whether it really should be in the Bible or not, they all say it's legitimate. So let's read through the passage. We're interested from verse 2 down to verse 11. It says, early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people were coming to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the center of the court, they said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now, in the law of Moses, commanded us to stone such a woman or such women. What then do you say? They were saying this, testing him, so that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped to the ground, stooped down, and with his finger wrote on the ground. And when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone and the woman where she was in the center of the court. Straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "I do not condemn you either. Go, from now on, sin no more." So let's go through the account. It's early in the morning, on the day after the Feast of Booths, as you read the context, starting in John 7. And Jesus was in the temple. People began to gather around him. And so he sat down and began to teach those who gathered. The scribes and the Pharisees then took this as an opportunity to test Jesus, is what we read in verses 3 through 5. So we need to understand, what was the test? What was it they were seeking to trap Jesus by? Well, one of the things we know is that Rome took control of Palestine, that area. The name is a Roman name for the region. They had issued an edict that no death penalties could be issued without their permission. In fact, we can see this stated in John chapter 18. John chapter 18 and verse 31. So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." Now here's the Jewish leaders, the very ones that were testing Jesus, making a statement to Pilate saying, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." Yet if you go look at John's account earlier, here about the adulterous woman, that is the very thing they're insisting that Jesus say. Again, take a look at, starting with verse 3. It says, "The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, having set her in the center of the court. They said to him, 'Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?'" They were doing that to test him for grounds to accuse him. They were trying to get Jesus to make a statement that was contrary to Roman law by supporting the Mosaical law. And then here's the problem, or what they thought was going to be an interesting problem, dilemma for Jesus. If Jesus said the woman should be put to death, then the Pharisees could go to the Romans and report that Jesus was teaching that the people should violate the laws, and he was advocating violence and death sentences. If Jesus let the woman go, then they would claim that he wasn't willing to uphold the law of Moses, and that he wasn't a real Jew in that sense. And as Jesus often did, he did what was unexpected. He ignored them. Which is an interesting response. He didn't say one way or another. He just ignored them. He reached down and started drawing on the ground. Now, people have long wondered what Jesus wrote. And you know what? There's no way for any of us to guess what was not recorded. So obviously it's not important what he wrote down on the ground. But it does mention he was writing. So why was it mentioned? See, by focusing on his writing instead of the accusers, notice what happened with the scribes and the Pharisees. Go back and look. Verse 7. But when they persisted in asking him, they kept insisting that he had to give an answer. See, the delay that Jesus brought in showed that Jesus was only answering at their insistence. He's not volunteering this. These people insist that he makes a decision. And it's important because the law required that judges make decisions in legal matters, not just somebody on the street. Take a look at Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 18. You shall appoint for yourselves judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. In other words, they had a law very similar to ours. In fact, ours is actually based on their law. We don't have vigilantes. We're not supposed to. You don't have people just deciding arbitrarily to take the law in their own hands and making their own decisions about the law. You have people appointed to make fair and righteous judgments. Here the Pharisees and the scribes are going up to a man who is not a judge from their point of view, and insisting that he make a judgment according to the law. Now, Jesus was a judge, just not one that they recognized. But they are the ones who are insisting. Take a look at Luke chapter 12. Luke 12 and in verse 15. Actually, verse 14. But he said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter over you?" Again, here's somebody who was coming up to Jesus to get a judgment done. And Jesus points out his role in this world was not as judge. He is the judge. He is going to be our final judge. But while he was here on earth, he wasn't acting in the role of a judge. But by their insistence, they were putting Jesus into the role of a judge. They were appointing him, in a sense, as judge. And it's only when they insisted that Jesus gave them an answer. And his pronouncement is what we started with in verse 7. "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to cast a stone at her." And then he went back to ignoring them. Now, the statement does not mean that only sinless men could uphold the law. See, that's what most people apply it to. They're saying you can't make a judgment because you have to be sinless. And well, no one's sinless, so nobody can make a judgment. Well, in that case, no one could ever uphold the Mosaical law. If that was what Jesus was saying, he was basically saying the whole basis for the law under Moses is useless because nobody can make any judgments. After all, as we note in Romans chapter 3 and in verse 23, we've said this many times, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All people sin. But what Jesus was actually referring to is a law that's again in the thing. Just like he was not supposed to be asked to judge on a law matter, they were supposed to take it to an actual judge. And there was plenty around they could have done it. After all, they were at the temple, and that's where the Sanhedrin meets, and that was the top court. I'm sure they could have found a judge. But they took it to Jesus. But there was another requirement in the old law. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17 and in verse 7. The hand of the witness shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. One that a lot of people don't realize. In the old law, when somebody was witnessing against somebody, they required a death penalty. It was the witness's responsibility to be the first one to cast a stone. The witnesses had to do that. They had to be so sure of what they testified that they were willing to carry out the death penalty. Think about that today. Make it think before you went testified against anybody, wouldn't it? If it's like today, if we had an electric chair and okay, if you witness against somebody, it's your job then to pull the handle. That's what the law required. So Jesus said, if the men who brought the woman and the charges were guiltless in this matter, if they were without sin, they should carry out the law. Now, I want you to notice there's a very subtle implication here. Jesus is basically agreeing that the woman was guilty of adultery. He never said she wasn't. He just said, okay, you who are the witnesses, you need the ones who are doing this without sin should be the ones who cast the first stone. That's what the law said. But Jesus put the decision whether to follow the law of Moses or the Roman law back on the people who are making the accusation. Oh, well, if we're going to support Moses' law, I'm the one who has to break the Roman law. And Jesus doesn't get trapped one way or the other. In other words, their trap became their own snare with what Jesus just said and pointed out. But there's actually more going on here that's often missed. See, the men clearly stated, go back to the accusation in verse 4. It said, they said to him, teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. That's an important statement. Because in the law, when someone is caught committing adultery, it is a death penalty. But take a look at Deuteronomy 22, which is where that law is at. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 22. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die. The man who laid with the woman and the woman, that she shall purge the evil from Israel. So here's a good question. Where's the man? The fact they only brought the woman and not the man demonstrates the fact that they are not guiltless. This explains why they disappeared from the oldest down to the youngest. The oldest ones, the ones that had a little more experience, realized first, oops. Not only were they in a tough situation, but Jesus said the one without sin, and they didn't bring the man. They let the man go free. Yet they were demanding the woman be killed. They're not guiltless. They're not without sin. They were hiding someone from the consequences of his sin. And so from the oldest down to the youngest who didn't realize until after they thought about it for a little while, they quietly disappeared. They had no case because of their own duplicity. And this then illustrates what we started with Matthew 7. In fact, go back there again. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that's in your brother's eye and do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Jesus' point here is not that you cannot judge, but he's saying that you got to watch out when you do make judgments because you're held to the same standard that you recognize. See, we have a real bad problem of excusing our own sins while we point out everybody else's sins. That's not fair judgment. That's not righteous judgment. If I'm going to help somebody else out of their sins, I first have to look at myself and make sure I'm not involved in sin myself. This is what the Pharisees and the scribes were guilty of here. They had brought a woman who committed it, was caught in the act of adultery, but let the man go free. They violated the law while insisting that the law be upheld. Well, their judgment, their insisting on the law being upheld, applied to them. And they got judged by their own judgment. They got trapped by their own snare. After a while, Jesus and the accused woman are the only people left. At least of the accusers. We can assume the other people that were listening for teaching may have still been present. But none of the accusers were any longer present. Now, the fact that all the accusers left is also an important point. Because when giving out a death penalty, the law required that you had at least two or three witnesses. You could not carry out a death penalty with one witness. Take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17, and look at verse 6. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. You had to have at least two or three witnesses before a death penalty could be carried out. Jesus knew the woman was guilty of adultery. He said so. But he asked her where her accusers were, the witnesses to the crime. She acknowledged that there were none there to accuse her anymore. Okay, death penalty can't be carried out by the law of Moses. That's what the law says. And Jesus said he would not condemn her either. Of course, that's what the law requires. She was free to go. But notice the very last statement in John chapter 8 and verse 11. John chapter 8 and verse 11. Jesus says, I do not condemn you either. Go, from now on, sin no more. Is Jesus saying, we're going to ignore the little fact that you've committed adultery? No. He's telling her, repent. You've got to change your life. Yes, you got away with it this time. But don't count on it in the future. You have to stop sinning. See, Jesus was talking about the death penalty, not the charge of sin. He acknowledges the fact that she had sinned. It was a fact they both knew was true. He told her to stop. And the implication is that if she would just change, then she would be forgiven. In fact, again from the old law, in Ezekiel chapter 18. Ezekiel 18. Starting with verse 21. But if the wicked man turns from all his sins, which he has committed, and observes all my statutes and practices justice and righteousness, he shall surely live. He shall not die. All his transgressions which he has committed will not be remembered against him. Because of his righteousness which he has practiced, he will live. Do I have any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the Lord God, rather than that he should turn from his ways and live? And here is a lesson also for us. We sometimes get so caught up in condemning somebody else's sins, and we forget the purpose that we're here for. We're here to get people out of sin. Ourselves and others as well. We're here to get people to heaven. Now, yes, to get somebody to realize they need to change, you got to point out the fact, hey, you are in trouble. You are in sin. But it's not, we don't say that to leave somebody in that sin. We say that so they can know what they need to change. See, neither Matthew 7 or this passage in John 8 are saying that others cannot point out sin. And in pointing out sin, they're not making up the sin. They're not creating a law by pointing it out. They're upholding what God already said and has already judged. But both passages are saying and teaching us is that when we try to straighten out the matter of sin in other people, we have to look first at ourselves. That was the point that was being made by Jesus in John 8. That's the point Jesus made in Matthew 7. If we're going to help somebody else out, we got to look at ourselves first. In Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. Starting with verse 1. It says, brethren, if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. When we need to help somebody out of sin, we look first to ourselves. Make sure that we are in the right state, so that we can help somebody else out of their state. Because it's a matter of trying to get people rescued from their sins, to save them from the death penalty they had invoked on themselves. My pointing out the sin or somebody else pointing out a sin to me, that doesn't make me lost. My sin already has made me lost. It's just somebody pointing out the obvious fact. But the point is that we need to change and become righteous. If there's anyone here tonight who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. And for those of you who are our children of God and would like the prayers of your brethren on their behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of the selected.